This podcast is a part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not reflect those of other podcasts or affiliates of this show or Gunna Geek. Check out other geeky podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com. Get ready, because the geekiness commences in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, the podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Whitten.
I prefer to jazzercise my demons, but yeah. And my co-host, Haley Malley.
That line you're worrying about crossing. Look behind you.
And Keir Hansen.
Gallifrey Public Radio. Now we have maths.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 100 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we return from a nail-biting hiatus, justify our numerous complaints over that period by claiming ourselves Scottish, and enjoy a collective sigh of relief as we realize that the Doctor, well and truly, is now in.
Woo!
Woo!
Yay!
Hey, it's on, everybody!
Episode 100, we made it, yay!
I am Haley Malley, and I am joined in the GPR studios this week with Keir Hansen. How are you, Keir?
Feeling 100% better, thank you.
It's good. It's good that you sucked it up.
I did. I sucked it up and swallowed it.
Phrasing.
Intentional.
And I am also joined by Jay Whitten. How are you today, Jay?
I'm doing fantastic. How are you?
I'm good.
All right. Well, yeah. After months of anticipation and excitement about not only the return of Doctor Who, but also the premiere of Peter Capaldi as the Doctor, we finally got to enjoy the triumphant first episode of Series 8. You know, we've got many changes that we're going to address, opinions that need to be aired out, and in the finest fashion of our beloved program, as many questions raised as there were answered. So I don't know about you guys, but I have been just, you know, on cloud nine for the past 24 hours.
I think I've been more adamant about watching and rewatching and note-taking and rewatching and going back and rewinding and catching scenes than I was about the 50th.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that.
This episode was probably denser than the 50th was.
Oh, by far.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the 50th had a lot in it, and it was a great spectacle, and it was a tremendously fun ride. But this one just had so much more meat to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's quite a bit that viewers were being given to chew on. There were a lot of things where there was, you know, some little tribute lines in there, very similar to the 50th, you know, where Moffat's doing one of his attempts to be able to say, okay, you know, tip of the hat to the old, embracing where we're headed with the new, no changes are permanent, but change is, and going about that route. But this just had a much different feel to it, because where the 50th was a celebration of look how far we've come, this seemed to be, where could we possibly go from here? You know, how far out of your comfort zone can we throw you and still have you want to come along for the ride?
Yeah. And there was a lot that he put in this episode that, I mean, fit the narrative perfectly, but was very clearly, you know, this is not this character speaking to this one. This was Moffat addressing the fan base. Mm. And it was done brilliantly. I loved it.
From the jump, I mean, all kinds of new things that we were being treated to along the way. I don't have all the numbers yet as far as the cinematic responses. Haven't been able to come across a lot of the culminated numbers. Just within the UK alone, it did not end up pulling the kind of numbers that the show had previously, despite the fact that it has become the global viewing experience that it is now, or has become over the course of the past year or so. You know, you compare it against some of the other debuts. When the show first returned in 2005, Rose was viewed by just under 10 million UK viewers, whereas this was 6.8, or about, you know, roughly a third of the viewing audience share on the BBC networks. Christmas Invasion was almost equal with Rose at about 9.4 million, and Smith's debut in 11th Hour was 8 million, so still higher numbers than what Mr. Capaldi just experienced. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that has something to do with the fact that because they were also doing the cinematic exposure, so maybe some of your audience was drawn that way, or maybe it's just not being calculated the same because of the fact that we're a certain percentage of us are acquiring our viewing material through alternative means or what have you, but I don't know.
And then you've got the digital viewing figures that you need to work into that, people that watch it on the iPlayer. Then there's the people that were able to get into the world tour viewings at both Cardiff and London. So that's going to be a big chunk of people too.
Right.
I mean, obviously not millions, I don't think, but.
Well, they also had noted that these are based on what they call the overnight numbers, mm-hmm. which have to do with the people that viewed it live at time. And it doesn't take into recent account developments of DVR usage, which are considered into final viewing numbers right. for opening night. If it was recorded on the opening night and then viewed later, it is later added to what was considered the overnight figures.
Yeah.
So
I mean, there's still time before we do get those final numbers. It usually takes about 2 weeks for them to put out final viewing figures. Mm. But yeah, so it'll be some time before we actually get a firm, solid grasp on what it is. But yeah, I mean, there has been a decrease, but a lot of that is due to the availability of it now. You know, you don't have to be sitting at your TV watching at that time. So
True. That
changes things.
Well, where do we start?
Oh, geez.
I mean, do we go through this chronologically, or do we just sort of, we go through kind of key elements and then just start drilling through, because there's just so much. You take the fact that running time was what, about an hour 16? Or so?
It was longer. Yeah, I can't remember the exact running time, but it was a good long one.
Oh, hold on. No, I've got the stats. Yeah, it ran a 76-minute episode, not counting the little the coda that they put in there for, you know, scenes from Next. Okay. So,
all right. Well, I mean, let's go ahead and start at the beginning. So, obviously, the very first thing we have, and we've been asked by a couple of listeners to address this, that there's a huge freaking dinosaur, like monstrous huge.
Right.
Yeah, and this, a lot of people have said that this is purely just spectacle, but, you know, first off, I mean, they address the size in the episode. You know, Jenny says, you know, that it's gigantic, and Vastor's like, no, they're all pretty much that size. And Jenny comes back with, I've seen fossils, and Vastor comes back again saying, I was there. So clearly, you know, the stuff in the Natural History Museum doesn't mean anything. That's an infant.
Well, Vastor was a very young girl when she saw these, so her perspective might have been a little off.
But you know, even the doctor says it too. He's like, I was being chased by a giant dinosaur. It's, you know, this is someone who knows dinosaurs. If he's going to call it giant, I'm going to take his word on it. Apparently it is a giant dinosaur,
and it didn't necessarily have to be an earthly dinosaur.
True. That's very true. It came from Siluria. That's what it was.
You'd never know. But I don't know. Personally, I kind of saw this as hit and miss. I mean, it goes along with the fact that, you know, right from the jump, we're talking about a show that kind of embraces some ridiculous elements and says, you know, we're going to put these fantastical situations together and just prepare to just have some fun with it. You know, we're going to throw hundreds of foot tall Tyrannosaurus Rex in the middle of Victorian London and let it crash around for a little while. But then at the same time, just as many people look at it and say, if you wanted to just have an unusual arrival for the TARDIS in its crash course of whatever it's just been up to since the last we saw them at the control panels, you might have wanted to use something that, you know, would have caused a different response from the populace, all the pudding brains, that didn't really seem to panic quite so much and just stand there and gawp. So I kind of see both sides of some of the initial public response to the episodes that we've been reading. It's minor.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is just basically another example of Moffat enjoying spectacle for spectacle's sake. You know, there's no real reason that you need a 300-foot dinosaur to, you know, open the show with. But it was cool, and it was a lot of fun. So, hey, throw it in there, you know.
It provided for a little, you know, some moments later.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'm okay with it. I'm okay with it. I wouldn't have personally, when we first saw the trailers and we saw the thing in flames, and I thought, holy crap, they're going to have some you know, rampant flaming dinosaur crashing through the Thames and whatnot. I thought we were going to get something different out of it, but I don't know. All right.
No, and I do want to say that I would qualify this as a legitimate kill for Moffat now. because no, we don't get a name of the the dinosaur, but
big sexy lady.
Yeah. Okay. There you go. But I mean, there was enough that happened prior to it that made you actually care about the creature. You know, the doctor promising to keep it safe and all of this stuff. And, you know, it becomes a part of the show that you're like, okay, this is going to be something that's going to go on and I'm going to care about this monster and we're going to put it back where it belongs. And now it's in flames and holy crap, it just died.
I don't know if you get that emotionally invested, because the doctor certainly doesn't. He very quickly, as soon as the murder happens, he's on the case and is no longer, you know, he's not really, it doesn't really carry a lot of remorse for letting that happen. He admits to it once, you know, I let this happen. I made a promise, but it doesn't persist. It just drives him forward. He's running on instinct through 90% of this episode. So it doesn't seem to quite stick. I'm not going to give this one the kilometer.
It's the closest that we've ever really gotten. Damn it.
Moffat works on a different scale when you're talking about killing characters.
I mean, it was a character that you could grow attached to, and it died, and it didn't wind up coming back by the end of the episode.
But it died from miles and miles away. You see the thing drop, and it's just bones.
Don't worry, she'll be back by the end of the season.
There you go. So now, and then we get the we barf up the TARDIS, or as the egg.
Your grasp of biology troubles me.
Right from that get-go, Vostra is on.
Oh yeah,
I mean, she Nev McIntosh kills in this episode. I adored her. I thought she was phenomenal. For her, some of her comedic elements, for some of her dramatic elements, I thought they've finally given her a little bit more. They've given all the Paternosters a little bit more out of this episode than they've had previously. So we get the TARDIS either barfed or lain, depending how you want. whether you want to listen to the police or not, and the full Paternoster gang coming down to do their initial investigation. Strax, obviously, right there, doesn't even get a line in yet before he starts into the comedic bits and gets shushed. So, although note that when the door slams again and he gets shushed, he calls out Doctor.
Yeah. I did catch that in one of my subsequent viewings.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's the TARDIS. Somebody opened up the door and you're like, well, wait a minute. You're not Clara. So, you know, I can understand him being confused at that point and questioning whether that's a doctor, because, I mean, obviously we've seen at this point that Vastra understands regeneration, and apparently so do Jenny and Strax. So whether they've been taught or have experienced it or whatever the case is, like, they understand the process. So it's not beyond the realm of possibility that, you know, that Strax is already putting it together, saying, could this possibly be?
To be fair, even if Clara had opened the door, he might have been confused and said, Doctor?
Possibly.
True. He's not exactly that observant. So we get our first look at the state of the regeneration that he's in, you know, either physical and or mental disorientation.
It's the green one and the not green one, or the other way around. I can't tell.
And the other one thingy. So they're giving him, and you can tell that this is something where, you know, if there were concerns about the fact that Capaldi was going to be coming at this stern and just bitter and possibly even very Colin Bakery or who knows what we were going to get out of him, they were softening the edges from the early stages by having him be kind of enjoyably confused. He's not at risk. He doesn't look like he's physically harmed, but he's just really disoriented and loopy. Mm-hmm. So I was picking up on something that between some of the physical failings, you know, the passing out bit, the crossing up of names, I get my hands confused kind of things, and those aspects, I was seeing Pertwee's regeneration, Baker's regeneration, Davison's regeneration, and Smith's regeneration. Well, maybe even Tennant as well. So, you know, it looked like they were really trying to work something where, you know, you've seen what we've done before. I mean, as you guys were talking about last week about, you know, some of the mechanics of the regenerations along the way, this was a hodgepodge, but it worked.
Mm. Yeah, I do have to say, I mean, especially like the line where Claire comes out of the TARDIS and he's trying to remember her name and she's like, it's Clara. Well, and his response was like, well, it's Clara or it might not be. It's kind of a lottery. Just that line, I close my eyes and I picture it coming out of Tom Baker's mouth. Like even just the delivery was just pitch perfect for that. And I don't know if that was just me, but that was definitely the vibe I was getting the entire time on the shore.
Quite a bit of it. Yeah. Yeah. It definitely felt that. So we get to our opening credits. Mm-hmm. So here we are now, kids. We're 15 minutes into our podcast. We've gotten to the opening credits. This is going to be a long night. Yeah. And lo and behold, we're seeing the as inspired by credits change.
Yeah. And I'll be honest with you. I did a side by side today, watched the official credits and watched the fan base trailer that it was clearly inspired by. And I've got to say, I prefer the fan based one still. Like there's something about it. Like maybe not the entire Fobwatch thing at the end. Like I'm okay with the angry eyebrows in the stars kind of thing, but the gears and the clock spiral looked better in the fan based one or the fan made trailer.
Huh. I haven't looked at the side by side, but I actually kind of liked a lot more of the Gallifreyan symbology and iconography and things that were used in the fan based original, as well as just kind of some of the font choices and things like that too. It seemed like more of a transition from what we've had before into something new. Whereas this one really took a kind of a cut and run, and it's very unlike what we just had last season.
Yeah, it's not a recoloring of the Time Vortex and a slight change to the music. This was a drastic change.
So the theme now has taken a major turn. Our theme music is now far less orchestrated, far more digital or electronic, as you'll take it. Mm-hmm. Although I had heard that this was rumored. You know, Murray Gold had been saying that they were going to be doing some things where they were pulling in some classic elements, and they'd been slowly working up to this. But they didn't go all the way back to the original theremin or anything. It has it's definitely a more of a classic sound, but not using the classic tones.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what I think of it yet. Even after hearing it a couple of times over now, I'm not so sure that this is one of my favorites. I kind of have weird opinions about the scoring through the entire episode, but that's just that's usually one of the things I pick up by about the sixth or seventh run through when I'm just listening and I'm not really watching as much.
I liked it. It's enough of a change that it was welcome. I haven't gotten to the point yet where I'm really critiquing it, but it was just, I heard something different and I'm like, wow, you know, 10 years, 9 years, whatever. And we're finally getting something that's not just a rehash of the same thing we had last year. Mm. So I was pleased with the different sound. Whether or not that sticks, I don't know.
Well, so we get into some of the aspects of now what we were told was going to be a more dramatic and long form episode.
Right.
So we've got the disorientation continuing. We've got some nice, good dramatic discussions. Let's kind of look at some of these, because dialogue here, as far as what Moffat put into this one, you can tell that he spent a lot of time choosing his words very, very carefully.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the first thing that we really come across is the discussion between Vastra and Clara about the, you know, the face that the doctor is wearing and how Claire is not okay with the fact that, you know, he's renewed, he's refreshed himself, but he's old. And Vastra being like, you know, well, why are you so upset about this? And it was just a brilliant exchange. But the thing that got me was the fact that, you know, yes, clearly it's Vastra getting after Claire for being so concerned about whether or not he looks young. And it's just, you close your eyes and you hear Moffat screaming at the fan base, like, he's still the doctor. It doesn't matter if he's not a young guy.
Right. Well, I was really, really impressed with this particular sequence. for a couple of reasons. One was obviously the fact that the dressing down was happening on two levels. There was the meta aspect of it, and then there was the obvious literary aspect of it. But there was also the fact that within it, there were some, again, Ned McIntosh just doing a phenomenal job of being able to put some real weight behind Vasra's character that she's never necessarily had before. She hasn't really been given as much dialogue, I think, or overall screen time as she had in this particular episode. Even in Crimson Horror, you know, she was still, she'd throw a couple lines and bounce and what have you. But this one in particular, in terms of the way that it was taking down the discussion of why do you think he appeared young before or to you, you know, and what that says, or why it was being done necessarily for acceptance. And the conversation didn't get to proceed far enough, but my extraction from that is obviously, or what I'm extrapolating farther is that if up until this point, and I'm talking since 2005 as far as show terms, he has taken these younger faces because he wanted acceptance on some certain level, whether consciously or subconsciously, and if he's not wearing one now, does that mean that he no longer cares about being accepted?
He definitely seems to have a harsher personality than recent incarnations.
Planet of the Pudding Brains.
Yes.
Yeah, and I mean, that's true. It's very... He doesn't, it's like he's got an agenda. There's something that he needs to accomplish, and being liked, it figures nowhere into that. You know, he has something that he needs to accomplish, and you know, you can either come along and help or you can get out of my way.
And it almost seems at times he doesn't even really want the help, because he's not turning around and asking for anything. You know, he leaps off the bridge and goes to chase off a lead on something, and they all just kind of look at each other. Well, I guess the doctor's on the case, you know. But he's not, or you know, closing the door with Claire on the other side. Sorry, oh, too slow. Bye.
I know. I was talking with a couple of friends as they were watching it, and you know, you could tell that they got to that point because they're like, "Did he really just?"
Well, yeah, it was yeah, he did. And Badger. He did he just do it?
Yeah, he did. Ass. Yeah.
But now, so you've gone back and seen it a couple times. Did he have it figured out already?
I'm convinced he had, you know, 12% of a plan.
he was better than 11.
He was definitely most of the way there. I think that he was going to get Claire out and realized this door's never going to open in time. I've got to take a different route. And he was already processing where he was going to go. That's why Claire was like, you know, give me the screwdriver. He's like, no, I might need it. I haven't fully figured out the plan yet, but I might need it. Shut the door. Mm.
I guess this goes back to one of the aspects of this regeneration that I was so intrigued with, was the fact that this was him running raw. You know, we've had instances where on some of the regenerations, you know, how much of his prior knowledge does he have? You know, how much of his wits does he have about him? Mm-hmm. You know, if he's left to just his raw instinct, what is he capable of? And we're seeing him in a very vulnerable state, or what appears to be a rather vulnerable state. And yet when something catches that very, you know, scattered, brilliant mind of his, and he tears off in some direction, like when he door boring, not me, yeah. Goes through the window, you know,
me.
Yeah. Leaping over buildings, crashing out of the tree, you know, jumping down on the horse, and knows to pull his screwdriver to unhook the reins, you know, and go off that way. I mean, he's running on his basics, but yet he's still driven, intuitive, adaptable, you know, capable.
Yeah, he's still the doctor.
Right. That's, at his core. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I've got to say, the exchange between him and Clara in the restaurant, absolutely brilliant. I loved that part. And the fact that, like, there were times in it where there was supposed to be tension, you know, when he's telling Clara, look at what's going on. And they stuck with it longer than they needed to. It was, you figured out what was going on, but then they held just a little bit longer to make you think, is there something more I'm missing? Or is it just, you know, it was just building tension? Mm-hmm. And it was just so brilliant. That's something that we haven't seen in a while.
This also, I've noticed, speaking of that scene in particular, I mean, through this entire episode, Clara got dressed down constantly.
Yeah.
I mean, she was taking it from all sides. I mean, either she was getting beat with a newspaper, or she was getting verbally bitch slapped by Vostra, or she was getting scolded by the doctor about, you know, being an egomaniac. You said it.
Yeah, right. You actually said that.
So, yeah. And I give her a lot of credit. Coleman stepped up. Her game was much stronger in this episode.
Yeah,
we've had a lot of people, you know, some of the folks in our circles that have given us some feedback have been saying that this is one where if this was the Clara that we'd had last series,
mm-hmm.
she'd be in much better overall fan standing right now.
Yeah.
This is the most I've liked her since the Snowman.
Yeah.
And if you look at this, one of the times that I watched this, I sat down and really paid attention to it on a meta level. Like, what is it that, you know, Moffat is portraying to the fans here? And if you look at the way that Clara is beat throughout this entire episode, this is the same thing that the fan base has done to the character ever since the introduction of Clara Prime. You know, mm-hmm. we've constantly been like, no, she's wrong on this, she's wrong on this, there's this problem, and there's that problem. And that's exactly what's happening to this. And it's, you know, it could very easily be seen as Moffat saying, look, you can throw all this stuff at her. She's going to take it and still come back to help the doctor. That's what's good about her character. And by the end of the episode, you realize everything that she went through, and she was still, you know, refusing in the face of death to roll over on the doctor. And you're like, you know, this is the fire. When she blew up on Vastra, you're like, this is the fire that she had in the Snowman that made her so endearing. This is what we were missing the whole time in Series 7B.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that stood out in a lot of people's responses as well. I mean, one of our, you know, we've had him on the show, Soleil chimed in and said that the how dare you come back mm-hmm. was one of his favorite moments. And that whole discussion about you might as well be flirting with a mountain range or what have you. I mean, it got a little furious there for a little while, and of course there's Jenny there to kind of break the tension on the whole thing.
Girl.
But that's kind of, I mean, it's so much of the dialogue on this, as far as, and you can say, oh, you can go ahead and call it weak writing, and you can say, oh, if you're talking to the fans, that's weak writing. You should be talking to the characters, and don't even, you know, never break the fourth wall. Well, screw you. Break the fourth wall. Talk to the audience. You know, they're the ones who are with you for this journey. And if you can put a meta element in there where, you know, you've got three people in a room and two people are talking, and things get kind of heated for a moment, and the third person in the room, who's actually your ears, is responding the way you are, going, whoa, or the applause, or whatever it is, I'm sorry, then that resonates.
Yeah, and this, I would say that this isn't weak writing. If it were in there clearly as a, you know, screw you to the fans or whatever, then yes, that would be weak writing. But everything that was in here, every element that we're saying was addressed towards the fans, served a purpose in the story. And it wasn't just crammed in there. It mm-hmm. was something that was crucial to the story. So I don't think that's weak writing. I think that's incredibly strong writing, that you can give it that many levels.
Right. Yeah. And it was taking apart aspects that really needed to be addressed
mm-hmm.
Within the story, within the nature of the program, the state of where the show is right now, these periods of transition. There were things that needed to get hit, and I think they were all kind of touched upon. The ones that we knew had to be addressed all were taken in order. And I know, as you and I were kind of, you know, texting back and forth with each other kind of live time, you know, we were saying, okay, achievement unlocked, got this. Okay, you know, next agenda, done. Okay, chapter closed, hit that point. We're like running off checklists of all these things. And then every once in a while, there would be some stuff where we were being given some, like, these little golden nuggets that we were not expecting. You know, some of these gimmies that we thought were thrown away months ago, years ago, that we were never going to get back. Like, who gave you the phone number?
Yeah.
You know, when that hit, I mean, I literally did the gape mouth thing, because I never thought we were going to get that back.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, even like him calling attention to the fact that this was a previously viewed face, you know, him saying, mm-hmm. I've seen this face before. Where have I seen this? You know, and I know, Kier, you've said that you're okay with it just being mentioned and dropped right there, right?
Well, it's kind of like this. It's all right. Everybody has their own theories. Everybody wants some sort of overt explanation. They want him to come out and say, you know, well, there was this time when I, you know, saved this guy and this family, and he was this marble guy, and he, you know, I felt bad. And, but that didn't, it didn't stick with me. I wouldn't have accepted something like that, because I went back and watched Fires of Pompeii over and over and over. And I said, you know, the doctor didn't care until the last moments. And Donna was the one that forced his hand. And even then, it wouldn't have been something that would have stuck in the back of his head about Caecilius, because he saved them. Mm-hmm. So that face would not have been one that burned in. But if I were to say that I needed some sort of, you know, overt explanation, I would have rather gone with something like the Frobisher theory, because that was the moment when the world was in crisis and the doctor wasn't there and bad things happened.
Right.
So, but with this, with him just saying, you know, what is so important that I can't even tell myself? I'm trying to give myself some point, but I'm not telling myself what it is. Just the fact that we know that he's struggling with those things on a level that's so folded into his millennia-old subconscious that he's not even allowing himself to work it through is enough to say, okay, he's a tortured soul. I get it. We love tortured heroes. Move on. I don't need it now. He's addressed it enough to know that it exists. Let's go.
Okay. Haley, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think they did a good job of name-checking it without giving a really specific explanation that would come off as, you know, fake, which I think probably would have happened if they'd done anything too specific to any one of the characters that he's played before.
No way to satisfy everyone.
Right.
So just touch it and... Just
blanket statement and let it go.
Mm. Yeah.
See, I can understand where you guys are coming from. The thing that sticks with me is like the fact that it was said, you know, what am I trying to tell myself? Why can't I just say it? Like, there's clearly a message embedded in this face. I don't think that that's going to be the last we hear of it. I think it's going to be something that is addressed later on. I mean, I'm glad that it wasn't just like, oh, here it is, and I figured it out. It means this and whatever. And I'm glad that it is something that's going to get drawn out. But I do think that it's something that we are going to hear about again later on.
Mm. Okay. If they do, I don't know if I'd be okay with it. I'm really kind of satisfied with where they've left this.
It depends on how they handle it.
Yeah. It's this double-edged sword. I mean, there's just no way they're going to be able to make everybody happy with it. So if they kind of leave this hanging like this, well, it's not even necessarily letting it hang. It's just saying, okay, we know there's an elephant in the room. Just
we see the elephant too.
Yeah. Okay. But, you know, right now we're going to make some jokes about big, long scarves. So we got stuff to do.
And then when he comes in after that and says, no, never mind. That looks stupid. I lost it. But again, that was another one of those lines that just, it was so quick that I didn't catch it until like my third or fourth viewing.
Pieces of it. Like each time I'd hear another chunk of that line and I'd laugh again.
That was another one of those great exchanges. And it was really the doctor and the tramp scene was really a monologue.
Yeah.
For all intents and purposes, the tramp did not need to be there other than just to be a set of ears. Mm-hmm. But they're formidable eyebrows.
You know? I love the fact that we went from the eyebrowless doctor to one who can, you know, open pop tops with him.
It's an attack eyebrow.
The independent state of eyebrows.
Independently cross.
And then the moment when he recognizes that he's Scottish. He's, oh, I'm Scottish. I can complain about things.
But he says it like six times. I'm a Scottish. I
yes,
am
you
Scottish.
Are Scotch.
I can hear it in your accent, sir.
I love the fact that he's like, yo, I can complain about things. And then a minute later when he's like, yeah, when he's talking about the spontaneous combustion, the tramp's like, what does it mean?
Blame it on the English.
I don't know, but I'd probably blame the English.
that exchange, or at least that moment for Capaldi was just showing the shades of what we can expect. You know, when we have these doctor in his own head moments, you know, we've gotten them from each of our doctors previously in certain episodes where they get these ones where they're grappling with something. You know, and now that he doesn't necessarily, or at least at the moment, have the Time War Hunt for Gallifrey weighing on his mind, you know, that's not the forefront. So right now everything is very intrapersonal, and so he's dealing with the man in the mirror metaphor. Mm-hmm. So this, I think, was exactly the kind of FaceTime that Capaldi needed with the audience to be able to say to them, I'm new to this too. You know, you're uncomfortable. You don't know what to make of this. I and what I'm putting into my character right now are feeling this through as well. We're both going to be on a journey for a little while, and it's frightening. You know, I'm terrified. You know, when he first mentions the mirror, when he's back in the bedroom and he's having the whole discussion about, you have an entire room for not being awake. You know?
Don't look in the mirror.
Don't look in the mirror. It's furious. I mean, the whole idea that, and everything that he's mentioning about his personal appearance, he's terrifying himself. You know, who put these frowns on my face? Who frowned this face? Is a it's a beautiful line. You know, Moffat just does a great job with the dialogue in this sequence, as far as I'm concerned, because it's just, it's very, I'm not going to say kind of Prince of Denmark kind of thing, but it's one of these very tortured souls, but he doesn't know why he's being tortured, because his subconscious won't allow him to know. You know, he's suddenly put himself into a situation where I don't know where these faces come from. You know, it just, your heart breaks for him, but at the same time, you want him to just suddenly click and get it and go running off, and it doesn't quite happen. So how are you guys feeling about the fact that we are coming back right now to what appears to be, at least from what we've gotten from this episode, we're coming back to the detective doctor, the one who says, shh, quiet for a second, pay attention, what's going on in the room. This is very, to me, very Sylvester McCoy.
Or even Tennant, too.
Okay.
I don't know. I always thought that made for a fun episode. Like, if it's not going to build towards the arc, but this one is just going to be a fun Doctor figuring things out episode, then that works really well.
Yeah, and if that's something that they can stretch out over the entire series, I think that it is going to work out really well. I think that if you have the Doctor focused on something throughout the entirety of it, I mean, we always said we loved when Matt Smith would be all over the place, and then at the end, you realized he was working the entire time, the entire episode, towards resolving this conflict. It was great. Can you imagine if we get that on a series-long scale, where little pieces of every episode hint to the fact that he has it all figured out at the end?
Okay. Yeah. Well, maybe in a slightly different way. A lot of times when Smith had those moments or those episodes, it was ones where, you know, here, let me show you how I figured it out all along. Mm-hmm. You know, back 35 minutes ago, I put the key under the mat here because I knew that this guy was going to be coming through the window. And Well, that's a slightly different take to the, okay, let's observe.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I'm saying, though, is like, I want to be able to go back and appreciate those moments when, you know, you're not, it's not that something is, you know, blatantly, I'm setting this up for later, but, you know, you can tell, he's focused on the issue at hand, but he's also thinking, how is it impacting the greater case, so to speak? Right.
Yeah.
He's working on the problem even when he's not talking about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rather than orchestrating something, because even as Clara says, and it's really one of these great gems of a line, you know, he doesn't do puzzles. He doesn't do complicated. He hasn't the attention span.
Yeah.
So, you know, everything is like, he may say he has a plan, but his plan is constantly just kind of falling out of his ear moment by moment. Because that's just the way he functions, since he doesn't necessarily see things linearly. So his plan may be something that, you know, develops after he's 75% of the way out the window. So, now, all right. So speaking of lines that did or didn't work, I wanted to ask the opinion on this because I actually was having a discussion with our friend Stargate Pioneer on this. You know, Star Pie had to say... He brought up a point on a line that Jay, you and I initially thought was just kind of a zinger, and that was the times like this, I miss Amy.
Yeah.
And we both kind of went, ooh, ooh, stingy. But he brought up a very valid point, and I wanted to throw this back at the two of you and get your take on it. Was that line necessary because of the fact that it was a deliberate stab at a companion that over the course of the past, dozen so episodes has literally sacrificed herself for the Doctor's well-being and helped save his home planet?
No, see, I think we're overthinking it. I think we're already questioning Clara, so we tend to go that way. But when I was watching it again with my wife this afternoon, I realized that all he is saying is the fact that Clara can't reach it, and Amy would still have 3 feet of legs left in order to grab it.
I got it then. I'm taking it. I'm going with it. She's got legs that go up to here.
Even though he dropped it like right next to his own feet, he couldn't get it.
Well, the thing that I adored out about that whole thing was the voice activation gag.
I don't want to talk about it. Or when she threw it at him and was like, did I hit something? And he's like, oh, the symbology. Or the symbolism. Just the play between the two of them, I think, was great in that it was always kind of strained. You never knew quite how they were with each other. And, you know, it built on that whole, you know, is she going to accept him as the doctor thing? Like, even when she had accepted that, yes, he is the doctor, was she going to accept that, you know, this was a doctor that she could travel with, kind of thing? Okay. You know, and playing on the whole, or further playing on the whole, you know, can I accept, or can the fans accept him as the doctor?
Mm. All right, then here's the tougher one. The fact that they spent a lot of screen time discussing flirtation. This may be one of the only things that I would say about this particular episode that I would call, in my opinion, more than just a nitpick, because I don't think they overtly flirted with each other in either direction. We've discussed this a lot over the previous episodes to say that this was more of a sibling relationship, mm-hmm. than anything else. So why do you think that they spent so much time repeating the word flirt over and over and over again in this episode?
You know, I honestly think that it might have just been the fact that that is something that was on a lot of fans' minds, and that was something that was verbalized from the fan base. I think that this was just a way of addressing all of that, saying, fine, you know what? There was flirting going on from 2005 until now. This is where it stops. You know, you can complain about it all you want. We're letting you know at this point that it has ended. There's not going to be anything more.
I think it also just gave Moffat a good way in on dressing down the audience for the he's too old thing.
Yeah.
Possibly, okay. Yeah.
I guess it was just because of the fact that it came up in about five different instances over the course, mm-hmm. of the episode. And I think one or two might have sufficed. I don't know. I guess so. But I kind of look at it as I had never really any concern. It wasn't as if there was a worry that they were going to have some sort of a creepy, flirty thing going on between the two of them now. I think they were going to just, it was kind of clear that they were not going to be pursuing that in any aspect. So they could have just put it out there once, maybe at Vostra's conversation, because that, in my mind, that pretty much laid it all out. There you go. There's your explanation. Yeah. He was not necessarily flirting with you. He was flirting with humanity, with these, mm-hmm. earthlings that he comes to hold so near and dear. He wanted to be loved by you. So he became something that was attractive to you in terms of his persona and his physical appearance or what have you.
Yeah, and it might have been something more, you know, if you look at fans who have only really been a fan of the show since 2005 and don't want to know anything beyond that. I mean, that's understandable, and okay, if that's where you're at, fine. But they might have been at the point where, you know, flirtation was a part of the show. I mean, as much as we might want to complain about it, that's the fact, is that, you know, even from Nine and Rose, there was flirtation back and forth all over the place with them. So, mm. you know, that can be something that someone may have seen as a part of the show. This is part of the story. So now that we have this old doctor, what's going to happen? Like, why? And it could have been that there was that concern in some of them, like, well, but they're supposed to be flirty with each other. How are they going to do that now? And might have been a response to that.
I don't know. There's this current that I keep going back around where it seems like every once in a while that a certain percentage of viewers, whether they be kind of, you know, dyed in the wool or new to the program or they've sort of come and gone or whatever depth you want to call it, start to see the show less as being the science fiction drama that it's been categorized all along, and start almost expecting it on a certain degree to be functioning as, in duality, as a romantic comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not necessarily required as part of the construct. It may be there at times, and that's okay. But and it's not saying that right now there's not going to necessarily be some of those elements, because, you know, when you didn't have any kind of an overt relationship between doctor and companion or anything of that sort, and it wasn't like a 10th and Rose or 10th and Martha or, you know, damn near 10th and anybody that came across except Donna, but you had River there. So, okay, there's your romantic element. And now we've got this weird thing with Missy, my boyfriend. We'll get to her in a second. And what the frack is that all about? So you're still going to get some of these little pieces, but I don't, I was so pleased with the fact that if you look at it from that 15,000 foot altitude and look down at this episode, this was back to some of the basics of what so many of us, both here on the show, the listeners, the friends of ours that are passionate about the show, when we talk about some of our favorite episodes and the things that just that we just adore about it, or the things that we talk about it when we're trying to get somebody else newly excited to the show, this episode hit a lot of those things and stayed away from a lot of the crap that we've said at times tends to muddy the show or pull it from what we think is the real heart of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do think that it was excessive, the use of, you know, beating the whole flirtation thing, but in the end, it's just, I'm glad that it's over. I'm glad that it's been addressed and we can move on now. You know, whatever it was that took that, you know, at least it's done.
Yeah.
But going back to what you were saying about the, 15,000 foot height, if you were at that height, would you jump or would you have to be pushed?
Okay. The pushed and jump discussion. So we've polled a number of people on this, and it's, I'm not going to say it's evenly divided.
No,
but we've got some strong dissenters. I understand both arguments.
Okay,
but I could.
Which one is your argument? Which one are you actually going to side with?
I'm going to Haley first because I don't want to answer this yet.
Okay. He in that scene, he said, "Unlike you, I do not expect to reach the promised land," which to me implies that he's getting ready to dirty his hands. And really, I don't see the moral high ground where you talk someone into committing suicide instead of outright killing them.
It's a valid point.
You really got nothing to be around for if you get down to the basics.
If you don't jump, I'm just going to push you, and nobody wants that on their ass.
So I kind of think he pushed him.
Okay. Jay?
All right. I have to say that I tend to lean towards he was pushed. I can see the validity in both arguments, and my wife gave me 5 minutes nonstop, not even to take a breath, of why I was a horrible person and why she hated me for choosing that side.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
She was very, very upset with actually both you and I in our pick on sides.
Jeez. Damn, Catherine. All right. No, Julie and I didn't have that argument at all. We were talking about, we both said, wow, okay. That felt a lot like, you know, some of these hard calls he's made in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And again, and I'm going back to the fact that with an episode like this, when you're in a pivotal episode, like a series finale or a series premiere or an anniversary or episode or one of those ones where Moffat steps in and says, I'm going to be the one writing this. I've got some very important things that I need to say. When he gets down to, you know, we've always said he's not really good at writing action sequences, but when it comes to writing poignant dialogue, the man can really nail it when he needs to.
Mm-hmm.
And the line that the doctor specifically delivers is, one of us is lying about our basic programming. Mm-hmm. You know, and the setup prior to that was that, you know, the cyborg was had been, you know, programmed centuries or who knows how.
Self-destruction is not in my core programming.
And murder is not in mine.
Right.
Well, I'm looking at this, you know, full mythos, because in my brain, yeah, and I know, all right, what classic movie and whatever, you're not listening, you're not watching classic Who anymore, put it aside, but Moffat is a classic Whovian and writes that way when he gets the opportunity to. So if that's the case, while we've got a couple people that have said, you know, or one in particular, you know, we're not going to name names, but his, you know, name rhymes with Vadger, says that the cyborg has been going through so many changes over the course of the centuries, you know, changing the robotic elements, changing the human elements, and back and forth, that his programming has changed and to have a full appreciation of beauty and things of that sort. But the line that the doctor delivers says that our basic, one of us is lying about our basic programming. And while the cyborg might have lost sight of, you know, what that basic programming might have been at one time, I mean, he expressed exactly what it was. The doctor's basic programming was based on his Gallifreyan collegiate training as a Time Lord 2,000 years ago or what have you. So, and while he personally has is against the idea of corporal punishment or murder overtly, if he's lying about his basic programming may state that when necessary, you revert to, you know, to the to those extremes. And he's done it before, more than once. So, in fact, even in New Who, 10th Doctor. Mm. So we've had instances where he's had to make the hard call, whether it was a villain that he particularly felt it was deserving to or not. I mean, I'm thinking now, dinosaurs in a spaceship.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've blown up baddies before.
Yeah. But, okay, and this is the point that my wife was very upset about, was that, you know, the cyborg or the droid had stood down. Like, he had lowered his gun. He was no longer fighting. So why would the doctor at that point, instead of during the struggle, why would he in cold blood basically take him and chuck him out? And she was upset, saying, you know, why do you want to make the doctor that kind of person? And, you know, that's that right there is what I think was so brilliant about the way that they handled the scene, because they didn't answer it. You know, even in the end part where, you know, Missy asked, you know, did you fall or were you pushed? It was hard to tell from here. And, you know, it, it leaves it to that point where you can say, this is who I want my doctor to be. And you can move forward with that. And you're not in conflict or not, you know, straight conflict with anything that happened. So the fact I really hope that they leave this unanswered, that it is ambiguous, because that means that the show can be so much more for so many more people.
Mm-hmm. You can choose to read that as dark as you want, because they give you the moment mm-hmm. where he's standing there alone in the doorway at that point, and he shifts his gaze straight to the camera.
Mm-hmm.
That's very telling. And there was no need to include that.
Yeah.
Unless you're trying to say, choose your own adventure.
Exactly.
You know, if you think the doctor pushed him, turn to page 76.
See, I get the feeling with, you know, Missy at the end, that this is probably something that is going to be addressed again later, that they're not going to leave it unresolved.
I don't think they're going to go back to this particular situation. I think the Missy thing is it's obviously going to spiral into something much larger. I think this is small potatoes in the larger scheme. But that does get us to this now. So who is this cuckoo?
Scary Poppins.
Scary Poppins. Welcome nice. To paradise. So she owns her little fleet of cyborgs. She's been slowly orchestrating some things behind the scenes for time untold. She may be somehow related to the fact that Clara was given the phone number by the girl in the shop.
I think that she was the girl in the shop. Like,
but I mean, she's not a girl.
She's a woman. It's, you know, just
this is Clara. When you've got
semantics,
Clara, who's,
come on.
No, this is Clara, who's hung up on age. Oh, if you're worried about the gray ones, you've got a lot more going on up there, even more than just one. Come on. She's not going to look at a woman who's in her mid to late 40s and say, oh, there's a girl in the shop. She's going to say, oh, this old bag. Hand me the,
I don't know. Do you can insert her into all kinds of places. You know, she could be the one pulling the strings, or she could be actively involved. You know, there's no way to tell right now. But I don't think that something like that, something as crucial as putting Clara and the doctor together, would be something you would give to a little peon and say, hey, you know what? Just do your best.
Well, there's a confusing element to this now, because we've been given an explanation as to why Clara's there all along.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're telling me that there is another force that
why all the other Claras have been there. This is Clara Prime.
Yeah.
Okay. Once again, you gave us an answer. You gave us an explanation that we were willing to accept begrudgingly. And now you're going to muck it up again.
Because this is Moffat.
He's got to provide an explanation for the question he didn't have.
He doesn't give you even like an offhanded reference to a question 3 episodes ago without giving you 5 more to go along with it. So, you know, this is what he does.
All right. So, other elements in here that we're still chewing on after the fact?
I want to know the opinion. What did you guys think of Matt Smith's cameo?
I mean, it was lovely and everything, but I felt it kind of took you away from Capaldi as the Doctor now.
Okay.
I wholeheartedly agree. It was nice that they did it. It was, you know, it was a nice heart pull moment, mm-hmm. but it was unnecessary, and it felt like it was a bit of pandering, because Clara, through the episode, had been waffling back and forth with how much she was accepting or assisting or distancing herself from the Doctor. And she wavered. I sat there and counted. I'm like, she's in, she's out. She's halfway back in. No, she's out. No, she's in. She's more in. She's running with him. She's protecting him. No, she's out again. And she was just, and you weren't expecting it necessarily. And I didn't actually need it to be resolved within this episode. I would have been okay, and we're not exactly sure that it's entirely done yet, that they end the episode with her still feeling very uncertain yeah. about it. But this felt like this push, like she was being shoved into saying, you know, like him, love him, accept him, call him your dad, buy him a coffee, compliment him on his suit.
All right, so what we got a lot of feedback from you guys this week, and we absolutely love that. This is great because it's just being able to extend the conversation with you guys is fantastic. But part of the feedback that we got was actually an exchange about this exact subject. And, our friend Dawn said that, you know, when it happened, she said, got Dusty in here on the rewatch, during Smith's moment. For me, it was effective, made me care for Clara. Also, I think it showcased how different 12 is. Let's face it, he's been granted something unprecedented, and how will that affect him? So just drawing the comparison between the two. Then our friend Soleil came in and said, yeah, I thought his cameo was perfect for all those same reasons. Then he said, there are detractors out there that I think may make valid points that at this point in the episode, Capaldi was the Doctor. Having Smith pop his head in was unnecessary. I agree with that point, but I do think it served the greater purpose of helping those people put off by an older Doctor to be more accepting of Capaldi.
I think that's where I might say I split off. Mm-hmm. Because at that point, I don't think that you need to, after you are now an hour in to this 76-minute episode, to need to put a scene in that is literally a handoff for the audience, mm-hmm. where Smith says, you know, thanks for being there, guys. Here's Peter.
You know, and I feel like the age issue had been addressed multiple times at this point, and you don't need to bring it up again. And even then, like, Smith's comment was like, yo, he's not old. Tell me he's not old. Like, you know, you have the previous Doctor fighting against the fact that we have an older Doctor after you've spent the entire time making us okay with it. And that just bothered me. And then our friend Badger Spoon put this perfectly. He said, I thought it was a nice moment with a great timey-wimey twist. On the other hand, if I have any issues with it, it's the same I had with the extended regeneration and Amy's appearance. It's a general lack of willingness to let go. Every regeneration up to this point was cut and dry, boom, one ended, and a new one begun. But I'm still not sure how I feel about that. And that's my whole hang-up, is the fact that it's like, when is this going to be enough? You know, when he blew up on the clock tower, I was like, okay, that's it, we're done with Smith. Wow, that was exhilarating. And then you see him, younger version. Okay, well, we get to say goodbye to our Doctor now. Okay. Then Amy comes in and takes away from, you know, Clara's moment. And then here, you know, here's this new Doctor. I've fallen in love with him, and he's great, and he is the Doctor for me at this point. And, you know, Clara ran off into the TARDIS without a second thought. We're good at this point. And mm-hmm. here's a call from Matt Smith. It's like, really? Why are we still dealing with this at this point?
Right. Well, and there's where it comes down to it. You know, is this being done for the audience? Is this being done for the characters? Or is it, you know, are we functioning on two levels here? If you're taking it between the way Coleman and Capaldi have been playing their exchanges throughout the episode, and this tension, the fact that they're not even certain whether they like each other anymore at this point, because they're sniping so hard, you know, calling each other egomaniacal, needy game players and what have you.
Sorry, it was the only one out of place. I'm sure you'd want it killed.
So, but another one of our listeners, Casey, you know, wrote in, and she was saying, you know, each had acknowledged the other's or their own and the other's confusion that they experienced about the regeneration process without coddling each other's egos about it. And while everything else is, you know, is going to hell in a handbasket, but neither one at that point really knew who he, you know, the doctor, was at that instant. But at the end of it, or by the time we get to this point, the doctor says specifically and overtly, "I need you." That could have been all that was necessary. If you had really been following through in all of the scenes prior and had listened to all the exchanges and had heard the different sides of it, whether it was being done between the two of them or from a third party that was trying to lay some explanation down as Vostra had done, then you should have been in a decent position to be able to say, all right, I'm either going to accept it because this is, it's a moment of crisis and this is a character that I care about and I want to see, you know, whether you're talking about her or him, and I want to see them be able to survive and thrive. Or you can just say, no, I'm not getting it. I just don't think that these two click. In which case you say, okay, now I'm going to watch next week and see whether it improves or worsens. You know, it could get worse, and maybe that's a good thing. Maybe they just get more and more at odds with each other. How cool would that be if they just end up traveling around hating each other for the next 6 weeks or something? But again, it's, you know, it, I don't know that this scene, that this, you know, take care of him, Clara, you know, he's gonna need you, look at him, you know, over there, he's not old, is he? Ooh, yeah. And they tried to make it cute, and it was endearing, and I get that. And I'm not going to take away the fact that they included it, but I just don't think it was necessary.
Yeah. So, all right, let's take a look at some of the other feedback that we've got. So, Soleil sent us a list of things that we need to address here. His first question is, what was up with the boing sound effect when the doctor's psychic link with Vastra?
There were a few stupid sound effects in this episode. That was like, somebody got a new soundboard and had to play with it.
Yeah, basically. He speaks dinosaur. Well, really? We're going to
baby
and horse.
Come on, he speaks. That's it. Just accept it. You know, he says, "Claire's how dare you?" Speech was brilliant, which yes. I agree with. The doctor can choose what he regenerates into. Why is he then surprised when he isn't a ginger? I don't think that it's an active choice for him.
Yeah, I think it's like a subconscious thing.
The doctor has said before that Time Lords can. Yeah, there are some Time Lords who are brilliant at it, and they can choose their face, you know, every single aspect of it. He said, "I'm not that good at it. It's more of a lottery for me." So there's a subconscious aspect to it, but the doctor's never been able to say, you know, he's never been able to sit there and say, "Focus on a dress size, focus on a dress size." You know, it doesn't work that way for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Romana could change at will.
Yeah.
So, and did, and it was creepy.
So, I mean, there's a, yeah. The doctor can't really choose which one he's going for. So that's why he's always hoping that he gets there. But, you know, that's not it. Yeah, then he makes comments that I'm Scottish. I can complain about things. He said that Clara was a tour de force.
This was probably her strongest episode we've seen to date.
Yeah.
I want to pause on that for a second, because there's one of these scenes, speaking about her particular performances, or maybe not necessarily, you know, Coleman's work, but just something that he did with her, and that was the school flashback. Yeah. Am I the only one that felt that was a little out of place?
Yeah.
I felt like they were setting it up for something later.
Definitely. I just... But you know, have the kids there. What are you going to do about it? Go ahead, do it.
If you had that same scene, take the school flashback out. Have her just, you know, get taken there, and then the droid threaten her, and she's like, "No, go ahead and try." That would make her so much more of a badass, and you don't have to explain where she got it from. You can bring it back later on, and, you know, have the doctor question her 5 episodes down the road, be like, "How did you know to stand up?" And she can be like, "Well, this is what happened when I was in school on my first day, and I just, you know, that's something I've carried with me."
Because we know that we're going to be getting more of her in the Coleman School later, that we actually have a scene We have that scene happen 6 episodes from now, where that girl does the whole "go ahead, do it" thing.
Yeah,
and we'd be the one to connect and say, "Oh crap, where that's
she's
where she
having
got
like
it.
War flashbacks when she goes into the school."
Yeah,
yeah. I mean that would have been a much better way of accomplishing it. I mean, this felt like. It felt like he needed to dumb it down so that people could understand why she was saying it when that was completely unnecessary. Mm. You could have just let her be Clara, be the companion we've all been hoping that she would be this entire time without giving her, you know, an experience to draw from.
Right. Yeah.
So, but he says that then Soleil goes on to say, you know, overall he was impressed. Besides small nitpicks, a truly excellent episode. It respects the history, ties things together, and lays the groundwork for the future. Well done, Steemo. Kudos. Bobby Honeycutt wrote in and said, second viewing of Deep Breath was amazing. I believe this episode will restore faith about Clara Oswald.
Agreed. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yep.
We had a listener, Danielle, who actually has a different opinion about it, said, you know, I tried, I really did, but no thanks. So, you know, I'll try and give him a couple more episodes, but it was lame and unfunny.
That's a choice of words that I'm kind of grappling with, the unfunny bit. I don't go into this program expecting it to be funny. Maybe that's what a lot of viewers want from it, because mm-hmm. that's what they were getting towards, you know, a certain aspect of 10 and definitely all through, you know, through the Smith era. But that's not inherently what this show is about. I mean, you still got your comedic elements, you got your Strax. It was only in there just to, at this point, you know, bless the poor man's heart, Dan Starkey can't do anything without just being, you know, a comedic effect, which I've got a point on that, but I'll get to that in a second. But well, I don't necessarily think that the funniness of the show is what's expected to carry it.
Well, and we talked to her a little bit later and said, yeah, trying to figure out exactly what it was that was the problem. She said, you know, seeing the trailer, she was excited. But when I saw the episode, my excitement went away and it didn't feel fun anymore. Mr. Capaldi was not bad. He did good playing him. I can't really explain why, but I didn't find it funny or why I didn't like it. Sorry. I do love the show and I'll give him one or two more episodes to impress me. So, you know, I think that it didn't feel fun anymore is more, probably more what she was going for. Okay. Was it, you know, it wasn't what, I'm not trying to put words in her mouth, but you know, it was a much different experience than we've gotten. And I get that. Mm-hmm. So it might have just been too jarring a transition.
That may also just be a personal take on what they consider fun, because a lot of people were saying that they loved what they consider to be the fun aspect of this, because it was so, so chaotic, mm-hmm. or unexpected and just, you know, and it was such a change to the formula that that's what made it fun, but that was their personal interpretation. Well, so,
yeah, and we have to think for people that there were a lot of people that came in with Matt Smith. So sure. For those people, that was all they knew. So this doctor, the dark tone and the more serious nature, while refreshing to those of us that have, you know, have a more extensive background, is completely out of character for some of them. Mm. So, you know, if you didn't enjoy this episode, definitely give it a couple more because in the end, this is the same show. It's still going to be the same show at the heart of it. So, you know, while one episode might not hit home, you know, Worms and Horror, it will get back to what it is that you love about it.
Right. Well, there's also just one more thing to kind of to take from that is the fact that when you go through a major change like this, because you're changing so much of your core format, you've got a little groundwork you need to do. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, you've got to give it sufficient time to be able to establish its legs. And you can't take the aspects of what you adored from just the last episode that you had been handed. Mm-hmm. And expect it to just, you know, run on the same pace. It's or not even the pace isn't even the right word. Just run on the same construct.
You've got to let the dust settle before you can see what the whole picture is.
Precisely. So Yeah, I would say, you know, and I'm glad she's going to give it a few more episodes, and I'm really hoping for the best that this is something that's just going to win people over, because as we've loved to joke about, the cycle of the Doctor change is the who the hell is this guy? I can't believe this guy is playing the Doctor. This guy's doing a pretty good job as a Doctor. This guy is totally my Doctor! Regeneration. Who the hell is this guy?
Exactly. And then the last bit of feedback that we got was from our listener, Jesse. He said, my 4-year-old son is confused by Peter Capaldi. This was his first regeneration, and I'm having difficulty explaining to him where his doctor, Matt Smith, has gone.
We're losing the 4-year-old demographic.
Hey, great for you. Like, you know, start him early. I got that. My 3-year-old son saw Capaldi on the screen and was like, that's the doctor. Yeah, literally said, it's the doctor. So I don't know where the disconnect is. I don't know how to
apparently,
help.
Apparently, there's that year of disbelief at age 4.
Yeah,
so apparently. You go before that, and then by the time you're 6, you're good again.
And then he said, also, did the face he ripped off look like Matt Smith to anyone else? That is a good question. I did not look for that aspect. I don't know.
I think it looked more like Maynard James Keenan from Tool, but that was just a different thing entirely. Another side conversation that I had with some friends of ours was actually discussing the Paternoster Gang specifically, because we weren't really sure what was going to be. We knew they were going to be involved. We weren't really sure how, and we've been discussing how the fact that that Vosser's really had been given an opportunity to be a much more poignant. Part of the, as we had discussed a couple weeks ago, carry him through, see him safely through this process. You know, she was the voice of reason in this. Mm-hmm. As soon as she realized that, oh, okay, here we go again. That she had somehow seen or at least was cognizant of what this could potentially mean for his experiences. Jenny, and their relationship. Jenny. Now, don't.
Sorry.
All right, now.
Sorry, I'm back.
Oh, Jenny. So, for art?
Right in the room.
Damn. But they even gave Jenny some great dialogue. Mm-hmm. You know, when they're having the discussion about the fact, you know, and Clara's turning to her and saying, you know, if Vostra had changed and she looked dramatically different, would you still like her? And you know, she doesn't miss a beat. She doesn't falter that, you know, that little impish smile of hers. She goes, well, I don't like her. I love her, you know. Mm-hmm. And as for being different, well, she is a lizard.
She's a lizard. Yeah.
So, you know, and this was something that I wanted to mention, because I know we've had this discussion with some friends of ours as well. Jay, you and I just within the last 24 hours had this discussion with a couple of folks about the overtness of the lesbian relationship. Mm-hmm. And whether we are now at a point where we can stop making a big deal about it and just have it be part of the construct of the characters. Okay, there's this couple, there's these people, there's the lesbians, there's those couple people over there, there's Artie who just got his eyes torn out, there's that guy over there. And it's just, it's not a matter of tolerance, it's acceptance, which in my mind and my personal belief structure are two very different terms.
Yeah. Well, and you know, this episode, the only reference we got to them being, you know, a lesbian couple was really when Vastra was like, you know, for the sake of everyone around, we keep up the pretense that she's my maid, but you know, that's all it is. And that's the only time we get anything to the fact that, you know, there's a problem with their relationship. You know, that's the only thing saying that this is out of the norm.
Yeah. So Jenny's response is, and yet I'm still pouring tea in the house in private.
It's a good pretense, isn't it? But the fact that that's the only time we get it mentioned the entire time is definitely a step in the right direction, because we weren't beat over the head with it for more than like 3 seconds.
Right. No, this was more about the interspecies thing this time around.
Yeah. Which, okay, if you want to draw attention to that, yes, that is odd. I've not had to deal with that yet, so.
Yet. Still 2014.
It's bound to happen eventually. No, but, you know, that's one of the things that, you know, Kiri, as we were having that discussion, you asked if, you know, if I felt like they had gotten it right. And I really feel like, you know, it's definitely a step in the right direction. And as I said, you know, I don't have any, you know, human lizard couples to compare it to, but so I can't say that it's not perfect, but it was.
I tweeted them the ones I knew, they didn't get back.
So do you guys feel like maybe the show chickened out a little bit at the end by having them not kiss in that fight scene at the end? By having that what appears to be a kiss, but yes, but it not actually being a kiss.
No, I don't think that was necessarily a cop out. There was a lot going on within that sequence that I don't think got a fair shake.
I've just got to say that whole sequence. I mean, we've said it before. Moffat can't write action, and that whole scene made me yearn for the brilliance behind the Batman and Robin movie. It was painful to watch.
Yeah.
But
well, here's my takeaway out of that whole thing, and this is maybe just me because of the fact that because I'll defend the poor guy. Strax was about to kill himself before being taken. And it was being done in painful slow motion, because the entire scene was within those final seconds, as he's drawing the barrel to himself. And it didn't seem to me like it was given any credence. He has been painted into being such a clown for the show that at these moments where he actually has any sort of relevance or some greater depth of character, as much as a clone warrior can possibly have depth of character, that it's just kind of tossed aside and we're back to the sight gags again.
Yeah. I have to agree with you there. It didn't feel like that carried enough weight. I mean, it was a tremendous act and it should, but they didn't hold on it long enough is basically how it felt. It looked like, oh, everybody's holding their breath. They're trying to get, and why is Strax pointing a gun at his face? And Vastor's saying no. And then they're all done holding their breath. Okay. Right. There could have been like a painful nonverbal exchange, like the, shaking the head and Strax being resolute. And it's give it a few more seconds. And I think it would have carried a lot more weight.
It might have left the door open slightly. And I'm still hoping that they're going to find some opportunity over the course of this season or within, the season or so to come to sort of reestablish the Centauran Empire to a certain degree. Because I feel it's kind of unfortunate that they've become kind of this comedic element.
The funny potatoes.
Yeah, the potato-headed stuff is just kind of, it's run its course. And while they have, I sat there and calculated, they gave Dan Starkey more screen time and more dialogue in this episode than his previous three appearances combined. And granted, some of it is great. I mean, the whole physical examination sequence.
The water bucket.
You're looking at my eye.
The water's fine. I bathed in it myself.
It was great because that at least showed that he still had a function. And yes, he was still being kind of, comedic. And he didn't really care too much about these other, mouth breathers that he's surrounded by. But he has a function. He's the butler. And then 5 seconds later, he's he's like the drill sergeant. You have to be in peak physical condition if you're going to be working with us and that sort of thing. So he had a role that he was good at, even though he didn't particularly care if he was doing it right. But I'm hoping we get a little bit of that back.
Oh, so, all right, last thing, we're running really long. But, I mean, there was a lot in this episode. Do you guys feel like the clockwork droids were a callback, or is that going to be something that's going to mean something later on?
Oh, and the fact that they were tying it so hard to the Madame Pompadour and Girl in the Fireplace references?
And I mean, you have the Doctor the entire time, like, this seems really familiar, and this is really ringing a bell, and then down to the point where he's like, the
sister ship to the Madame de Pompadour.
Yeah, he's pulling fuses out of the fuse box that literally say, SS Marie Antoinette.
Yeah, and he's like, sister ship to the... Nope, I got nothing.
Still not quite firing on all cylinders.
It's
tip of my tongue. So I'm seeing myself jumping through a mirror on a horse.
So was that just a fun way of displaying, he can't quite get there. He's not quite all together. Or is this something that's, since he didn't figure it out, going to continue?
Meaning, are we going to continue to have the clockwork?
Or is there going to be some connection between those two that pays off later on?
It seems thin if they were to do it. I mean, Girl in the Fireplace was a nice standalone
one-off.
Yeah, it didn't need to have a greater piece to it. It was, you got the nature of who the clockwork marionettes were, and that made sense. I mean, they love working with these things. They have variations on them popping up all through the place. You got your Tin Santas and so forth. But I think they're going to have to use them to a certain degree because it seems like they're somehow intrinsically attached to this mysterious Missy. But
Okay, so do you think that they're going to work retroactively and try and insert Missy somehow into Girl in the Fireplace?
No, I don't. I personally don't think so. I think it might run parallel, but I don't think they're going to try to overlap it.
Okay. Haley?
I don't know. I think this is probably the last we've seen of the droids.
Okay. I was just curious. So how quickly did you guys figure it out? At least have an idea that these were similar to the other ones?
Probably when they were down in the larder.
See, I think in the restaurant, I was starting to be like, I know, I've heard that gearwork sound before, I don't think I pegged it then.
That was the same thing that tipped me off, because Girl in the Fireplace is one of my favorite episodes, and I go back and watch that all the time. And that was, that's in the little pack that I give people of like, here, watch these few episodes. That's one of the first two or three. As soon as I heard the gear work, I was like, that's the exact same sound from the droids and girl. And then the stunted movement kind of thing. I'm like, are they really going to go there? And it took me a while before I really believed, okay, they are making that connection. But as soon as I heard that sound, that's what tipped me off. So.
Yeah, I guess, I don't know. And some people have been catching some other connections too about the fact that throughout a lot of the restaurant sequence, the doctor kept smelling roses because Rose was, companion for Girl in the Fireplace. And I'm like, well, yeah, that's painting it a bit thick there.
It's
but
reaching.
Yeah, just a tad. Yeah. But no, I mean, it's, I love, this is, again, Moffat loves making these little connections. He loves, doing his tapestry work. Where he'll give you a new piece of fabric, but it's laced with all of these threads of things that you're familiar with before so that you could say, oh, you're nicely done. Nice callback.
Yeah, but when there's something like that that you really have to reach for that connection, there's one word that pops into my head that makes me stop. And that's light bulbs.
The fracking light bulb. No, that one dimmed. It dimmed. It dimmed.
So, all right, well, let's go ahead and wrap this up and move into the news because we are running really long this week.
It's our 100th. We're celebrating.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we've got some. Imagine that. The show comes on and everybody's like, oh, okay, now I'm just going to watch this. But apparently Doctor Who Confidential is kind of making a return. This news story is basically that they are going to be starting to extend some of the content towards the internet. And we are getting something very similar to Doctor Who Confidential, but it's only available, what is it, on the iPlayer?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's very, very restricted to the iPlayer. It's 10 minutes, and it just seems like a cheat to me.
Well, we had been told that we were going to have all these opportunities to have extended content. Whether it was webisodes, things like that. And then we were hearing about for this thing, be able to join us before for the pre-show and after for the after-show discussions and these things. But then if you start telling us that there are regional restrictions or that they're on proprietary players or things of that sort, and you're going to lock out some of the global audience that you've worked so hard to establish over the course of the past 9 years, specifically, or just within these 9 years, you're doing yourself a disservice. So I'm hoping that they're just going to, come to the realization, because this is something that they can correct very quickly, and be able to just change their distribution formats. But, there are enough people, Chris Hardwick and others, who just want to talk about these things all day long. So
I wouldn't know anything about that.
Well, yeah.
Glasshouse is here.
We did just make reference to the fact that this is episode 100. Stop.
Got a box of rocks here, man.
All right. But then the next bit of news that we've got, apparently, according to Mark Gatiss, there will never be a Doctor Who Sherlock crossover.
Because it would be stupid.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is, Moffat has come out before and said that he's in favor of the crossover, but was being held back by the quote unquote Killjoys in his Sherlock team. So you've got Moffat who's like, yes, I want to put these two of them together. And Gatiss is like, no. No.
Killjoys, common sense havers, whatever.
They're all a bunch of right bastards.
Yeah. But then in reference to the rumor that Jenna Coleman is going to be leaving the show, both Peter Capaldi and Jenna Coleman have addressed this. And Capaldi said, I'm not looking for a new assistant. I don't know where these rumors have started. I mean, I've read that she might be leaving at Christmas, but I don't know even if she'll get to Christmas. You've got to wait and see what happens. So him hinting at the fact that she might already be gone. And then Coleman, and you can tell she's been working with Moffat for a little bit because this little blurb is great. She said, "The truth is, I don't want to tell you the truth because I quite like these rumors. And I think it's really interesting because suddenly people don't know what's going to happen in the series and people don't have any idea. So this speculation is quite good. People can now watch the show not knowing if I am or not. And that is quite exciting." So I'm going to give you an answer, but there's going to be absolutely no information in it just because I like to watch you squirm.
She's learning how to Moffat explain.
Exactly. I mean, I was reading that and I was like, I swear I've read this exact same kind of thing from Stephen Moffat. Oh, but yeah, so that's all the news that we've got this week, actually. Cause we don't care about news at this point. We have our show back.
Everything else is freaking obvious.
So next week we do have episode 2, which is Into the Dalek or Into Dalek or I don't know. It's something about going into a Dalek. I don't know. The Next Time trailer that came on afterwards, so it did seem like, did anyone else, when the doors blew off the elevator or whatever it was, get a very Matrix feel?
I didn't get a Matrix feel from that.
No. It looked almost exactly like the same when the elevator blew up and the doors bounced through.
It does this slow-mo and then picks up again. Okay. Yeah.
Right. It was just the way that the doors blew off. I was like, wow, they did that in the Matrix.
Yeah. I just thought, it's going to be another one of those many, many corridors scenes.
Yeah.
Like, we got 300 yards of corridors on this set. We're just going to keep turning the camera around and shifting the lights slightly.
Paint this wall a different color. Now run back through the other way.
Hang a tarp on it this time.
Put more round things. I used to have lots of round things. I wonder where I put them.
Yeah. The sad thing is there's probably still more that we could bring out of this episode.
But we're not going to, because we're going to bring that up in the feedback and the discussion. So go ahead over to CallifreyPublicRadio.com and sound off, or send us an email or tweet us or Facebook comments or, on the posting.
Or the Gunna Geek forum. Go to GunnaGeek.com. On the forums, and the episode posting will be right there, and you can talk in there. It's brilliant.
Yeah, or if you've got an iPhone, you can search the Tapatalk app, search Gunna Geek.
Yes, yep. Tapatalk is a very helpful little damn thing.
Oh, yes.
Oh, hey, quick little addendum. Mm-hmm. If anybody in the listening audience is planning on being at Dragon Con next weekend, tweet us and let us know, because I will be down there. Julie and I and a number of us, other Whovians, a lot of our listeners, are going to be converging on Atlanta for Labor Day weekend for all 4 days of Dragon Con. Hopefully getting an opportunity. I'm going to see if I can wheedle a little bit of FaceTime with Colin Baker. Let's see if I can pull some strings. My interview, my press pass and whatnot. Don't know what that's going to be able to do for me, but if I get thrown out, you'll be the first to know as I'm tweeting. but let us know, because I'd love to track you down. I love bumping into listeners, so it'd be a great opportunity. So, yeah.
Awesome. So final thing, we just want to say thank you guys for helping us get to episode 100. This is I never thought when this started that we would actually make it to three digits, but we just want to say thank you to all of our fans that are out there, that you make us go.
You five people are awesome.
Yes. So
thanks for listening, Mom.
Thanks, Haley's mom.
But we do just want to say thank you. This feels like a tremendous triumph, and it is thanks to you guys. So we look forward to being there for the next 100 episodes. Well, this has been episode 100 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, look at these eyebrows. These are attack eyebrows.
And this is Kier saying, I like to skip ahead to my bits. Saves time.
And this is Haley saying, I give you air from my lungs.
We'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows by calling 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1477 to leave us a voicemail. You can head to GallifreyPublicRadio.com to leave comments on each episode. There you can also keep up to date on all the latest news and gossip, as well as what's going on in the community. Also, make sure to head over to GunnaGeek.com to find out lots of other high-quality, geek-centric shows. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2014.